not necessarily you. Now let's get sciencey. Today we'll talk about Tyrone Hayes and his fight against big agribusiness, pollution-resistant fish, not the ones in your campus bound, and many other stuff, for example, Cosmos, the legendary show of the 1980s with the immortal Carl Sagan, who died almost 20 years ago, has now a follow-up on the Fox network in the States. It is presented by Neil deGrasse Tyson and produced by the same guy who brought you The Family Guy and American Dad, which hopefully doesn't tell us anything about the quality of the new show that premiered last Sunday. I haven't seen it yet, but I recommend anyone with legal and or other form of access to the video material to have a look. First on from FysOrg, a new paper in Nature by Sturm, Köhler et al. From the Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg claims to have made the most precise measurement of the mass of the electron up to date. To clarify it to our student colleagues who study law, economics, social, or other non-sciences, the electron is one of the most fundamental building blocks of matter. They have a negative charge and surround the nucleus of the atom. They are also responsible for the conduction of electricity, after which they are named. According to some brilliant mind at our Institute of Bioinformatics, there exists only one single electron in the whole universe, because that is the best explanation why all electrons have the same mass and the same charge. Obviously, they all must be the same particle. So where's the Nobel Prize? Back to the Heidelbergensis. Those smart guys around Sveinstrom weighed the electrons using a panning trap. That is an experimental device so complicated there is even a Wikipedia article on it, so check it out. They measured a single electron that was bound to a carbon nucleus whose mass was already known. The electron has, it has a mass expressed as a decimal number with many zeros and digits after the decimal point. I will spare your feeble mind the burden of the exact number, but let's say its mass is around 1/2000th of a proton's mass. I don't have to, the estimate is a 13-fold improvement in accuracy on previous attempts at determining the electron's mass. Am I too fast in talking? I don't have to tell you how important that is to your life, because... Yes, next story from Eureka Alert. Eureka Alert is an online science news site operated by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, in short, AS. Eureka Alert provides a platform through which academic institutions can share their research with the world, and it is a website I rely most on because other prominent websites like FysOrg often copy their stories verbatim. For example, the following research from the Northeastern University in Boston. Who likes to play fair? And I'm not talking about some kinky games you play in your private dungeons. I'm talking about fairness, social justice, and the stuff that you may be interested in if you are positioned on the left side of the political spectrum. We often think of playing fair as an altruistic behavior. We sacrifice our own profit to give others what they deserve. What could be more nicer and more selfless than that? But according to philosopher Rory Smith, playing fair has a rather dark companion. Smith studies spite. Technically speaking, spite is to pay a cost to harm others, without gaining any benefits from it, other than Schadenfreude maybe. You work very hard to destroy someone without any positive outcome for yourself, sometimes even harming yourself. That is spite. So why would evolution let spite stick around? Evolutionary biologists have been thinking about this for decades, and it is still unclear why this seemingly pointless behavior still exists. Smith, whose research has been published in Proceedings of the Royal Society B, thinks spite is what keeps people playing fair. Smith tested his hypothesis using an economical experiment called the ultimatum game. In this game, one player proposes a division of resources, say money, and the other player can either accept or reject. Suppose each interaction concerns the distribution of 10 €1 coins. The first player could suggest that he takes 5 euros for himself and gives the remaining 5 euros to the second player. That would be a fair game. However, that first player could also keep 9 euros for himself and gives just 1 euro to the second player. The rational strategy for the second player would be to accept 1 euro instead of nothing. But in real life, people almost always reject the offer, in which case, both players go away empty-handed. Therefore, fair plays will do well in the presence of spite. Since they don't have to make, since they don't make unfair offers, they don't risk being rejected by the spiteful players. So fairness actually becomes a strategy for survival in this, or shall I say, in Orland of spite. The next story is from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, which is situated in Boston, well, which is situated somewhere in the United States, I assume. For decades, waste from nearby manufacturing plants flowed into the waters of New Bedford Harbor, a large and busy seaport in Massachusetts. The harbor is contaminated with polychlorinated biphenyls, abbreviated as PCB and heavy metals, and is one of the largest clean-up sites in the United States. That is, it is still less polluted than our campus pond. The harbor is also the site of an evolutionary puzzle. Atlantic killifish are not only tolerating the toxic conditions. The killifish, by the way, is, well, it's a fish. I mean, and only two kinds of animals, edible or not. And in that case, I'm definitely not going to eat it. So Atlantic killifish are not only tolerating the toxic conditions in the harbor, they seem to be thriving there. And they somehow have been able to adapt and live in such highly contaminated environment. In a new paper published in BMC Evolutionary Biology, researchers found that changes in a receptor protein called the aryl hydrocarbon receptor 2, or AHR2, may explain how killifish in New Bedford Harbor evolved genetic resistance to PCBs. So normally when fish are exposed to harmful chemicals, the body steps up production of enzymes that break down the pollutants, a process controlled by the AHR2 protein. However, if AHR2 is overstimulated, it disrupts cellular functions, leading to toxicity. So in the New Bedford Harbor killifish, the AHR2 system has become more resistant to this effect, while they simply shut down the whole pathway. So while the fish seems to be immune to the toxic effects of the PCBs, they can still transfer contaminants up the food chain, that is, to us humans. And despite their healthy appearance, they still lack the whole pathway that was the AHR2 gene protein. We don't know what the unknown negative costs for those fish are. Researchers will look next at whether the adaption affects how the killifish are able to respond to other kinds of stressors in the environment, such like low oxygen levels. Apropos fish thriving in poison. By the way, if you feel like laughing, please do it aloud so that everyone can hear it, okay? Thank you. Apropos fish thriving in poisonous environment. Has anyone investigated those duckling-eating carps in your campus pond? Because some chemicals must be responsible for the existence of those big-mouthed monster fish. So why is nobody from the chemistry department? Oh, we don't really have a chemistry department. Whatever, why is nobody looking into that? I mean, it's a giveaway master's thesis. So if anyone picks up this idea, I will finance the study with a generous amount of, say, beer. Also, we'll be organizing a boat party, playing loud music, and getting drunk to call attention to the ecological disaster that is our campus pond. We don't have set a date yet, but it will probably be the day before you notice some intoxicated bodies floating in the water. I'm quite, well. The following is a summary of an exposé by Rachel Aviv, published in the New Yorker magazine, on biologist Tyrone Hayes and his fight against Syngenta, the producer of atrazine and one of the largest agribusiness in the world. So most of it is copied verbatim from the article. If anyone from the legal department of the New Yorker is listening, please don't sue me for copyright infringement. Sue the GKU Hochschulerschaft if you have to. Atrazine is the second most widely used herbicide in the US, and it is applied to half of the cornfield there. The most popular herbicide, glyphosate, is produced by Monsanto, another big cartel in the agribusiness. A study by the Environmental Protection Agency found that without atrazine, the national corn yield in the United States would fall by 6%, creating an annual loss of nearly $2 billion. However, the herbicide degrades slowly in soil and washes into streams and lakes. Atrazine is one of the most common contaminants of drinking water. An estimated 30 million Americans are exposed to trace amounts of the chemical. In 1994, so that was 20 years ago, the APA announced that it will start a scientific review on the health effects of atrazine. Syngenta asked Hayes to conduct experiments on atrazine. Syngenta, which is based in Basel, Switzerland, sells more than $14 billion worth of seeds and pesticides every year and funds research at some 400 academic institutions around the world. When Hayes agreed to do experiments for the company, the students in his lab expressed concern that biotech companies were buying up universities and that industry funding would compromise the objectivity of the research. Hayes assured that his fee would make his lab. Do you want to share your things with the with the audience?
It's fine. I'm not sure the microphone reaches back here.
Well, that is unfortunate. For the next show, we'll arrange the microphone accordingly. Well, anyway, again, thank you for being here. And if anyone is close to the studio, then feel free to have a look here. Well, so where am I? Yes, so Hayes agreed to do experiments for the company, and he was paid, I think, $1,100 for that. And but, well, as I said, the students in his lab was concerned that biotech companies were buying up universities and that industry funding would compromise the objectivity of the research. But Hayes assured them that his fee would make their lab more rigorous, he would employ more students, buy new equipment, and raise more frogs. When his experiments showed negative health effects of the herbicide on tadpoles, he was surprised by the way the company kept critiquing trivial aspects of his work. Hayes wanted to repeat and validate his experiments, but the company slowed him down. He feared that his reputation will be damaged because it appeared that he was part of a plan to bury important data. So finally, he ended his relationship with Syngenta. Hayes repeated the experiment using funds from Berkeley and the National Science Foundation. After dissecting the frogs, he noticed that some could not be clearly identified as male or female. They had both testes and ovaries. Others had multiple testes that were deformed. Oh, well, the internet here doesn't work, so.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, yeah. In papers in Nature and Environmental Health Perspectives, Hayes reported that he had found frogs with sexual abnormalities. Oh, there's a... Well, fun. Well, anyway, not our concern. So in papers in Nature and Environmental Health Perspectives, Hayes reported that he had found frogs with sexual abnormalities in atrazine-contaminated sites in Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, and Wyoming. Other scientific findings suggest that the herbicide is associated with birth defects in humans as well as in animals. There is strong evidence showing that atrazine disrupts male reproductive development. And studies in the Journal of Pediatric Surgery found that mothers living close to water sources containing atrazine were more likely to have babies who were underweight or had a defect in which the intestines and other organs protrude from the body. So, if I were to raise frogs or humans in America, I would avoid cornfields. And after some time, Hayes became convinced that Syngenta representatives were following him to conferences around the world. At his talks, he noticed that one or two men in the audience were dressed more sharply than the other scientists. They asked questions that seemed to have been designed to embarrass him. Like, why can't anyone replicate your research? Why won't you share your data? And one former student said that everywhere Tyrone went, there was this guy asking questions that made a mockery of him. And they called him the X-Man. I mean, I wonder how much you get paid for doing that job. So Tyrone Hayes worried that the company was in a campaign to destroy his reputation. He stopped talking about his research with people he didn't trust. He instructed the students in his lab to hang up the phone if they heard a click. He started carrying an audio recorder to meetings and stayed at different hotels each day, whenever he traveled. Hayes even suspected that Syngenta held focus groups on how to mine his vulnerabilities. And several of his students remained rather skeptical of his paranoia until an article appeared in Environmental Health News disclosing Syngenta's internal records. Hundreds of Syngenta's memos, notes, and emails have been unsealed following the settlement of two class action suits brought by 23 Midwestern cities and towns that accused Syngenta of concealing atrazine's true dangerous nature and contaminating the drinking water. Tyrone Hayes' work was critical in the success of the lawsuit. They actually didn't win, but they got a settlement, which was quite a lot of money. The company documents show that while Hayes was studying atrazine, Syngenta was studying him, as he had long suspected. Syngenta's public relations team had drafted a list of four goals. The first was to discredit Hayes. In a spiral-bound notebook, Syngenta's communications manager wrote that the company could prevent citing of Hayes' data by revealing him as non-credible. He was a frequent topic of conversation at company's meetings. Syngenta looked for ways to exploit Hayes' frauds and problems. Notes on Hayes include things like grew up in a world that wouldn't accept him, needs adulation, doesn't sleep, was scared for life, and what's motivating Hayes? Basic question. Good question. They documented peculiar things he had done, like he kept code on, or phrases he had used, if his line clean. They noted that Hayes was getting in too deep with Enviros, and searched for ways to get him to show his true colors. So Syngenta also commissioned an outside contractor to do a psychological profile of Hayes. Well, I wish someone would pay me so much attention, while it saves me from writing diaries. Syngenta also made a long list of methods for discrediting Hayes. Have his work audited by third party, ask journals to retract, set trap to entice him to sue, investigate funding, and investigate wife. One of the company's communications consultants said in an email that she wanted to obtain Hayes' calendar of speaking engagements so that Syngenta could start reaching out to the potential audiences with the error versus truth sheet, which would provide irrefutable evidence of his polluted messages. Underquote. The PR team suggested that the company purchase Tyrone Hayes as a search word on the internet so that anytime someone searches for Tyrone's material, the first thing they see is Syngenta's material. The proposal was later expanded to include phrases like amphibian haze, atrazine frogs, and frog feminization. Fuzzy critiques of scientific experiments have become integral to what is known as a sound science campaign, an effort by interest groups and industrials to slow down the path of governmental regulation. Corporations have developed sophisticated strategies for manufacturing and magnifying uncertainty. Started by the tobacco industry, many companies have adopted this tactic. In field after field, year after year, conclusions that might support regulations are always disputed. Animal data are deemed not relevant, human data not representative, and exposure data not reliable. Syngenta's public relations team compiled a database of more than 100 supportive third-party stakeholders, including 25 professors, who could defend atrazine or act as spokespeople on Hayes. The company paid a tenured economist $500 an hour to study how a ban on the herbicide would affect the economy. The finding has one, and I quote, basic takeaway point. A ban on atrazine at the national level will have a devastating effect upon the U.S. corn economy. In an online Forbes op-ed, a journalist who is listed in Syngenta's records as a supportive third party accused Hayes of being attached to conspiracy theories and of leading the international regulatory community on a wild goose chase, which borders on criminal. The question is, who is the criminal here, right? Syngenta's public relations team wrote editorials about the benefits of atrazine and about the flimsy science of its critics, and then sent them to third-party allies who agreed to byline the articles. So when a few articles in the op-ed pipeline sounded too aggressive, a Syngenta consultant warned that some of the language of these pieces is suggestive of their source, which should be avoided at all costs. And when a 2009 paper, so 4 years ago, in Acta Pediatrica found that children conceived between April and July, when the concentration of atrazine in water is highest, those children were more likely to have genital birth defects. Syngenta actually forced the author of the paper, Paul Winchester, and requested that he turn over every email he had written about atrazine in the past 10 years. Jason Rohr, an ecologist at the University of South Florida, criticized the lucrative science-for-hire industry where scientists are employed to dispute data. Rohr has conducted several experiments involving atrazine, and he said that at conferences, he regularly get peppered with questions from Syngenta cronies trying to discount his research. They try to poke holes in the research rather than appreciate the adverse effects of the chemical. Many of his colleagues were not willing to delve into this sort of research because they don't want the headache of having to defend their credibility. Syngenta wrote letters to the editors of prestigious journals to dissuade them from publishing papers critical of atrazine. The company also filed an ethics complaint with the Chancellor of Berkeley, where Hayes is professor, claiming that his emails violated the university's standards of ethical conduct, particularly respect for others. Syngenta posted more than 80 of Hayes' emails on its website. Berkeley declined to take disciplinary action against Hayes. The university's lawyer reminded Syngenta in a letter that all parties have equal responsibility to act professionally. Syngenta also hired a communications consultancy, the White House Writers Group, which has represented more than 60 Fortune 500 companies. The firm held elite dinners with Washington influencers and tried to prompt members of Congress to challenge the scientific rationale for an EPA review of atrazine. In a memo describing its strategy, the White House Writers Group wrote that, and that is really fun, "Regarding science, it is important to keep in mind that the major players in Washington do not understand science." In 2010, EPA found that the studies indicating risk to humans were too limited. And 2 years later, during another review, the EPA determined that atrazine does not affect the sexual development of frogs. The conclusion was based largely on a set of studies founded by Syngenta. One of the co-authors was Alan Hosmer, a Syngenta scientist whose job, according to a 2004 performance evaluation, included atrazine defense and influencing EPA. In 2012, in its settlement of the class action suits, Syngenta agreed to pay $105 million to reimburse more than 1,000 water systems for the cost of filtering atrazine from drinking water. But the company denies all wrongdoing. It still maintains that atrazine does not, and in fact, apparently, they believe, cannot cause adverse effect at any level to the health of people. Michelle Boone, a professor of aquatic ecology at Miami University, said, "We all follow the Tyrone Hayes drama, and some people will say he should just do the science. But the science doesn't speak for itself. Industry has unlimited resources and bully power. Tyrone is the only one calling them out on what they are doing." I want to finish this story with Hayes' own words. In an email to his students, he wrote, "We and our principals have been tested, and I believe we have not only passed, but exceeded expectations. Science is a principle and a process of seeking truth. Truth cannot be purchased, and thus truth cannot be altered by money." That was our first broadcast. I hope you excuse me for all my pronunciation and microphone errors. I hope it was still listenable. You see, many of my colleagues here at the station cope with the stress of this demanding job through the consumption of copious amount of inebriating substances. I don't, or at least haven't started yet. Well, I might have started yet, but let's see, for the sake of the script, I have not. Therefore, the quality of my show may suffer from my sobriety and other factors. Well, anyway, I hope you enjoyed it, or at least don't despise it so much as to call for my cancellation. And if you have any interesting news, if there's any newsworthy research here at the university, feel free to contact us. I'm very happy to report on the going-ons at GKU. We don't have a theme song yet, so I'll play you out with some high-quality silence. Thank you for listening to Campus Radio Linz. I'm Boyang, and I hope that you all will tune in next week at the same time to Talking Science. Thank you. By the way, my show might be at the end, but Tom and Andy are still here, and they might share you some of their valuable experiences at the uni.
We'd be glad to, if no one else comes in barging at the door and kicking us out.
I don't think so, but well, have fun.
Oh, this is the second week. Was the opposite.